This is the Kids Health Network, the health and psychology podcast for parents and carers of children.
The Kids Health Network is brought to you by GP and my daddy, Dr. Andrew Leach. Thanks for tuning in, everybody.
Today we welcome back Miriam Kirby, a clinical pediatric psychologist who has extensive experience working with children with autism. Rates of autism prevalence suggest that boys are, on average, 4 times more likely to have autism than girls. But this figure may hide the true incidence of autism in girls and women, as it can be harder to diagnose and even go unnoticed in some. New research suggests that current diagnostic methods overlook girls. Parents with daughters on the spectrum will often share frustrating tales of how difficult it was to get a proper diagnosis for their daughters. Some take until adulthood to reach this. Thanks for joining me today, Miriam.
Thanks for having me, Andrew.
So, Miriam, why is it more challenging to diagnose in females?
That's a really good question, Andrew. I'm actually really lucky that I get to see a number of women with autism or coming to see me to discuss whether or not they are in fact on the autism spectrum. And through speaking with these women, it's really helped me to understand some of the earlier experiences that they went through and how their diagnosis got overlooked. So, for example, while the women as girls were aware that of some of their differences, it was often put down to things like they're just shy.
Anxiety.
Yeah. And while their parents might have had concerns about them, and even if girls do go for a diagnosis of autism, they might be perceived as being too social for that diagnosis. So I think the criteria around the social communication deficits, that's where sometimes girls get overlooked because they can present as quite social. And also we have those stereotypes of what we think autism is, so lots of repetitive behaviours, difficulties with changes in routines, really obsessive interests, and that stereotype of, you know, the math genius and things like that that's sometimes perpetuated in, you know, in the media or through movies and things.
So are girls quite good at some of these areas that are in the diagnostic tool? So like you mentioned the social side of it. So is it that, you know, girls are actually quite good at overcoming that difficulty with social interactions? So they put on a really good front, so therefore they go under the radar a little bit.
Yeah, there's lots of research coming out lately about camouflaging in girls with autism, girls and women with autism. It's not exclusive to girls and women, like boys and men can do camouflaging as well. But it's thought that girls are more socially motivated. So they're looking at what's expected perhaps socially and perhaps better able to imitate or copy their peers. They can, you know, some of them do want to fit in, and so they will take on the characteristics of their peers or characters they see in films and movies to try and fit in and to appear normal.
Okay. Can we go back a little bit, because we did talk about the diagnosis of autism, what requirements there need to be to actually diagnose it based on DSM?
Yeah, yep. The DSM-5, yeah.
So are you able just to sort of tell me about those diagnostic criteria again, just so any listeners who haven't heard that first podcast can be updated?
Yeah, so autism has two broad categories. So the DSM-5 criteria include deficits in social communication. So that's things like two-way social interactions, understanding your own emotions and those of others and responding appropriately to them. It's the way people use their nonverbal communication and understand other people's nonverbal communication. And it's also includes making and keeping friendships, understanding relationships. Mm. And then the second broad criteria is restricted and repetitive behaviour patterns, which could include repetitive motor movements, speech patterns, or use of objects. It includes a desire for sameness, difficulties with coping with changes in routine, inflexible thinking, strong interests or unusual interests, and the difficulties with sensory sensitivities or sensory seeking behaviours.
Yep. Okay. So have you got some examples of how, you know, girls might present then, you know, putting those criteria into context, you know, and I'm sure it depends on age as well. What sort of, you know, typical things would you see presenting in a girl with autism?
So quite often I'm seeing girls who are maybe late primary school or teenage. That doesn't mean that all girls get diagnosed at that age. A lot of girls do get diagnosed in the early developmental period. But the girls who haven't been diagnosed earlier have presented quite similar to their peers in terms of their interests. So their interests will be typical of other girls. They might have friends. They might be overlooked because they've been quite anxious, and it's put down to an issue with anxiety or being shy.
Mm, that's a really tricky one. We see a lot of anxiety now. And it can be very hard to distinguish the two. I think I'm still learning. How do we know the difference between social anxiety, anxiety, autism? It's, you know, is there a crossover? Do they come together? Or, you know, is there a distinct difference crossing from one to the other?
Yeah, so you can certainly have autism and an additional diagnosis of an anxiety condition. But anxiety is quite prevalent in any individual with autism, because I guess one of the main features is that for many, they really prefer things to be predictable and know what to expect. And I guess there are many variables in life that are unpredictable and unexpected. So there can be some underlying anxiety that comes along with autism.
So would that be a hint if your child is struggling with routine, there's, you know, a constant breakdown when the routine's not stuck to, is that a hint that maybe that anxiety is also possible with autism as well? Or it's not an exact science like that?
It's not an exact science, but we definitely would explore anxiety, explore that further, and what situations it occurs in. And we're just trying to make a difference, a decision about whether there's a specific fear underlying it. What I wanted to say also about younger girls is that they're not standing out too much until kind of mid to late primary school. So during the, you know, early primary years, kids are sort of just enjoying running around, playing kind of simple games in the playground. But then as we're getting older, the games start to get a little bit more complex, and the social interactions get a little bit more complex.
And that's when it becomes obvious?
It becomes a bit more obvious with girls trying to fit in with their female peers. So they might struggle to understand some of the conversations or interests of their peers. So some girls will comment to me they don't like the drama that other girls get into, or they're not interested in the same things the girls are talking about. You know, maybe if they're into gossip and things like that, or if they get a bit socially competitive, that's difficult for girls on the spectrum.
So what is the average age of diagnosis of girls compared to boys?
So I've just read some information that said sometimes girls aren't getting the average age is around 9 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. And is that difficult when it is? I mean, are we ideally wanting to see them a bit earlier, or is it just it is what it is, and 9 is still something that can be worked with, you know, in terms of helping them through that school, those school years, and with social interactions? Is there any way we can catch them a bit earlier, or it's hard? It's really hard.
I think just with greater awareness, that will hopefully come. And I guess the earlier a child can be diagnosed, the better able we can support them. So I guess, you know, doing things like this hopefully raises awareness. There's a lot of within the autism community and professionals who work with the autism community, there's certainly a lot more advocacy happening.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about some of those, that age group having trouble with discussions, emotions, gossiping, girl type interactions. And so are there any signs that might be obvious in the kindy to pre-primary, kind of young primary years, that would be a possible thing for parents to seek help about? So friendships are just starting to form then. It's you know, often they jump between different kids at that age. Is it more to do with the routine breaking that can be challenging, or the emotional regulation that's challenging, or it's actually very tricky?
Certainly, say for example with the emotions and managing emotions, so there might be some evidence there in terms of the extremes or intensity of emotion. So if there's a lot of difficulty with compliance, or the intensity of emotional upset, or the duration that it lasts for, that could be a clue. With their peers, a girl that's maybe a little isolated, or who has difficulty when there's more than one person in the mix, or who might be bossy and directing play. Looking at the way the young girl plays with toys, so whether there's any repetitive use, whether she's doing any imaginary type play.
Is that an important aspect, I guess, at that age, imaginary play?
Play can be an indicator, so difficulties with imitation and imaginary play. The thing with girls is that they can be quite good at that. They can be quite good at copying a model, you know, at doing role plays, copying things that they've seen, like looking after dollies and things like that. So, yes, it is tricky.
So my girls are quite interested in Frozen and you know, Barbie dolls and those sorts of things. Is having a fixation on these things a normal part of development? And I would expect it is, but when is it too much? Is there you can draw the line anywhere to say this is actually, you're actually overly fixated on Frozen, you know?
Yeah, and you'd probably argue that many people are overly fixated on Frozen.
Exactly.
So with this topic, with interest, we're looking at the intensity of the interest. How much stuff they're collecting, how often they're, repetitively watching Frozen, whether they're rewinding certain bits. So I don't know if Frozen's a good example.
No, it's probably not. No.
So, with interest. So if it's Barbie dolls, for example, we might be... you know, when a girl comes in for an assessment, if she's got access to a dollhouse or Barbies, we'd be observing the way she plays with them. So whether she's enacting a specific scene, girls I've observed will sometimes just dress and undress or organise.
Repetitive things.
So it's more like organising these Barbies in what they're going to wear and where they're going to sit and where the furniture is going to be placed.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, when you have a really good look at it, they're not really... They're either doing a routine script around the play, or they're just organising and reorganising.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting. And it can be very tricky, and that's why it was, we're talking about it, you know, taking up to years to work out. And I certainly don't want to over-label kids either.
Yeah, that's right.
Because kids do have specific pleasures and things they like Disney and Frozen, and that doesn't necessarily mean anything. It's a childhood thing.
Yeah, because I guess any one of these things on its own wouldn't necessarily mean autism.
No.
It's when you put it all together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about sensory issues? I know that they're often important and come into play. So trouble with taste, touch, you know, loud noises, difficulty going to sleep. I know there are important aspects of working this out, and so children with autism often do have trouble with strong flavors and swallowing, and therefore appear quite fussy. So is that the same with girls as well?
Yes, certainly girls can present with those sensory differences as well. A common thing that crops up is clothing and textures of clothing and tags on clothes and preference for soft, comfortable fabrics. Can get down to, you know, difficulty with uncomfortable shoes or as well as tactile things, definitely can have all those sensory preferences, seeking behaviours and things that they try to avoid.
How do you work with those children that are struggling a lot to wear tags on clothes and particular textures and that overwhelms them? How do you work with them?
I think that mainly with that kind of thing, you can often accommodate some of the clothing preferences.
So just play along with it, do you mean? Or
Well, as a parent, I'd probably just dress my child in what they're comfortable in.
Yes, it's a lot easier, I can tell you that. Yeah.
But sensory difficulties in general, quite often an occupational therapist will be really good at working with that area.
Yeah, I agree. I think they are they're good at using different techniques to try and get the child used to strong sensations or different sensations, and had some success with that pathway. So
yeah,
it's good to use that.
And I guess there's a spectrum of that as well in terms of how challenging the sensory difficulties can become. So you can
Before today I was reading some interesting research that suggested girls with autism with this particular dietary or food aversion can actually wind up being diagnosed with anorexia because of that process. And then they also found in the research that females with anorexia have a higher level of link to autism, about 23% link in this study that I was reading. Again, it's not always linked, it's not always this leads to this, but have you ever seen anything like that in terms of your work?
I haven't personally had experience with girls with autism or women with autism who also have an eating disorder. It's something I'm kind of just learning about too, that there's a lot more information coming out.
So how are girls with autism more vulnerable both in school and in society?
So I think girls are more vulnerable because they do have this desire to fit in socially. You know, while they are trying to fit in and copy from peers, they can be taken advantage of, I guess. They can be vulnerable to being bullied or teased, or, you know, if the model that they're copying is not ideal, you know, maybe they can engage in some unhelpful, risky behaviours depending on, you know, the group that they're with. Yeah.
Risky behaviours as in like drugs and alcohol, or risky,
yeah,
or
could
other
be that,
you know,
or
sexting, that kind of thing. Disinhibited behaviour.
It could be. Also, I guess they're vulnerable to not really being understood well by other people. I think that's
people are unsure how to approach them. or
yeah, they might not just have a good understanding of the differences in the way they interact with others or their interests or their needs, I suppose, and accommodations.
Yeah. So in school, is there more awareness now in schools, and is there more support for schools with the NDIS coming into play and more funding and teachers sort of becoming a bit more aware of how to help support these children?
There's definitely a lot more advocacy for happening when it comes to education for individuals with autism.
So we've covered a bit about the younger kids entering school, the older kids who are at school, but what about sort of the adolescent and adult girls? Do they also have challenges going into the world, and what might some of those challenges be?
For adolescent girls, sometimes navigating friendships and being at school can be quite a challenge. So a lot of the girls I see are quite able academically, but they struggle with the social demands of school and even being in the classroom environment and participating in their learning activities. Not that they can't learn or they're not good at learning, they find all the other sensory aspects quite challenging as well. So a noisy, busy classroom or coping with changes in rules or expectations.
And school can be quite rigid with rules, and it can be quite strict and overwhelming for kids. I imagine, you know, loud bells and kids screaming or whatever. I can imagine it being a very daunting experience.
Yeah, even like the disruptive classrooms can be really a challenge.
Are they more vulnerable to bullying?
Yeah, I believe they're more vulnerable to bullying. Some women I've spoken to said they've, really done a lot of observation when they're in high school about, how to behave so that you don't stand out. But the cost of that is quite draining emotionally, mentally. Going home at the end of the day really exhausted from, all the work they're doing to learn and try and fit in.
And so as they leave school, is it harder to enter the workforce because of all that?
Yeah, I think it can be difficult. I mean, there are many people with autism, including women who are in the workforce. Some of the women I see, though, do say there are some challenges with the social demands of the workplace, the stereotype of having a chat at the water cooler, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Fantastic at their job, can really do well with processes and systems and, getting on with the job.
Yeah.
But some of the, other demands of, like a open plan working environment, for example, could be challenging because you've got people coming and going, it's noisy, it's busy.
Just to sort of conclude, I guess if a parent was concerned, I imagine a GP would be a good point of call just to start with, just to discuss some of these concerns, potentially going on to someone like yourself, a psychologist.
Yeah.
And what sort of work would you do with children, particularly girls? What sort of work do you do to try and help them with their various anxieties and difficulties fitting in at times? So, how do you support them as a psychologist?
So I guess as a psychologist often, we're working on emotions, understanding emotions and looking at ways to, reduce anxiety. And so that's kind of been my focus traditionally, emotions management and social skills development. But as I'm learning more and meeting women on the spectrum, I'm really starting to think it's quite important for us to place a lot of value about who that person is, what their strengths are, validate their interests, and appreciate them for who they are rather than look at it from a problem perspective and looking at how we might fix this, but just how we might kind of understand and how we might, make some changes to our expectations or the environment they're expected to participate in.
Helping them make life easier.
Yeah.
That's really
and
good.
And value, you and know, valued. What they've got to share or, you know, value their perspective on things sometimes.
It's so important. So important to spread that awareness and to show that, you know, girls with autism can fit in very well into the community. And so it's a really positive thing to think about in that drawing on the skills that they bring and that they can live a very healthy life, normal healthy life. So I think we've talked about a lot of things there, Miriam. And do you know any good resources, or should I put them up on the podcast at the end?
Yeah, so I've got some information from Yellow Ladybugs, which is an advocacy group for women and girls on the spectrum, or particularly girls. And it's an Australian-based group.
Fantastic.
I'd like to...
Yeah, I'll put that up. And thank you so much for your time today. Appreciate you coming back to talk to me.
Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Andrew here. Find out more about this episode and others, as well as resources that I've found to be useful, at my own new website, drandrewleach.com.